little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics, and my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
I'm so excited about the guest who's all connected up with us and ready to go.
Topics for this episode include lying in politics. Never heard of such a thing. Different types of lies. Why people fall for lies. How fact-checking works. Resources for fact-checking. The response of journalists to political lying, and a host of other topics.
And our guest honed his journalistic skills of investigation and reporting at the Tampa Bay Times in St. Petersburg, Florida, where he gained wide-ranging experience covering many different beats, including the Metro beat, business beat, and politics. While there, he acquired expertise in aviation affairs and his reporting, focusing on the crash of a Boeing 737 on September 8, 1994, killing everybody aboard, led him to later write a highly praised book called The Mystery of Flight 427, Inside a Crash Investigation. But his name, Bill Adair, would become indelibly associated with politics. After he became the newspaper's Washington bureau chief and began interviewing top politicians and describing the sausage-making of politics to his readers. So with this base of experience, he went on to found PolitiFact, one of the first political fact-checking organizations, and broadened the practice by co-founding the International Fact-Checking Network. So as a highly regarded expert on fact-checking, Bill has given numerous presentations at conferences and other venues in the U.S. and around the world. He's appeared on a lot of media programs, such as the Today Show, Nightline, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and the Colbert Report. And then back in 2013, he accepted his current position at Duke University as the Knight Professor. That's K-N-I-G-H-T, Professor of the Practice of Journalism and Public Policy, where he teaches journalism at the Sanford School of Public Policy and directs the Duke Reporters Lab. So we're very much looking forward to this discussion with Bill, including information from his very readable recent book called Beyond the Big Lie, The Epidemic of Political Lying, Why Republicans Do It More, and How It Could Bring Down Our Democracy. Bill Adair, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Well, Bob, that introduction was just amazing, and I've never had all those things collected in one place. It's incredibly flattering. I'm really honored to hear all that, and it's great to be here talking with you. And of all those things, actually, one I should mention that for my students is the one that really matters to them, and that's that I was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and none of those things you mentioned matter to my students as much as being on The Daily Show and trading jokes with Jon. So maybe that's the one that really matters.
Yeah, I actually saw that. And actually, Jon made you laugh, too. I love that part.
Really, he made fun of Duke, and I enjoyed that, and we had a great time. So anyway, it's great to be here talking with you. I love talking about my work and talking about facts and lying and politics and my book. So happy to talk.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. It's great to have you with us. I guess we'll just kind of start off with a little bit of a 30,000 foot view, as they say. Journalism, a career in journalism, getting into journalism, it can have a lot of different trajectories. You can do a lot of different things in that pursuit. Can you give us some insight into the influences that guided your career journey toward specializing in fact-checking?
Well, first I should mention that I got into journalism because my mom told me to. And we should always do what our parents tell us, you know? So this is an important lesson. Kids, if you're listening to this, do what your mom tells you. And I did. My mom, when I was about a sixth grader, said, you know, you should become a reporter. And I was like, oh, okay. So I did my career report in eighth grade on being a journalist, and I still have a copy of it. And it said something like, journalists don't make a lot of money, which was true. And also that you have to be curious. And that was the thing that really drove me as a reporter, still drives me today in the journalism that I continue to do, and is the fuel, I think, of anyone who goes into this very interesting work. Because to be a journalist is to have a license to be curious. And, you know, you basically have the license to ask anybody anything and explore how things work, why things are the way they are, to question authority, which is sort of the path that I went down eventually that led to my fact-checking work. My path, and you summed it up well, Bob, I started off as a local reporter covering local government, and I enjoyed that. I covered transportation. That led me into a beat of covering aviation. And for about 10 years in the 1990s, I've covered aviation safety and the business of airlines. And that was really interesting. And I found that airlines had all the elements of an interesting beat. They had conflict with unions. So that led to interesting stories about wealth and power. They had interesting technology that was being developed in the 1990s that set airline fares. And so I enjoyed that. And then I got into covering aviation safety. And of course, those were life and death stories. And as a journalist, I found that I really liked writing about things that were about the high stakes of people's lives, the drama of plane crashes. You mentioned my first book, The Mystery of Flight 427, which was based on a newspaper series that I wrote for The Times. And so I really enjoyed that. I switched beats in about the year 2000 because I realized that aviation safety was not going to yield a long career because there just were not going to be a lot of plane crashes. A lot of it was getting repetitive. And you sort of had to write the same story over and over again. And so I switched beats to politics, started covering, I moved to Washington, started covering Congress and the White House for my newspaper. And it was there that I really began to see lying and began to see it increase in the early 2000s. It was really in concert with the growth of the internet. And really, you can't separate these things. I think the growth of lying is very much intertwined with the growth of the internet. The internet makes it so much easier to lie, to spread lies, to connect people with the politicians that they love, that they will support regardless of whether they lie. And so that's really, I think, been the great enabler of political lying. And so as I saw this begin to grow, I realized, okay, this is something that I want to focus on. And that's what ultimately led me to get into fact-checking.
Bill, right out of the chute, beginning to talk about your book, let's tackle that provocative, at least to some people, not to me, but some people, subtitle of your book, The Epidemic of Political Lying, Why Republicans Do It More, and How It Could Burn Down Our Democracy. Along with that book's cover, showing a bright red flaming tie at the tip. What's behind the story?
That tie is pretty subtle, isn't it, Bob?
It is. It lights the way to reading your book. What's the story behind that title's framing?
Let's take them separately. So the epidemic of political lying, I started to address a moment ago. So I think the epidemic of political lying really began in the late 1990s, early 2000s, in concert with the growth of the internet, as I indicated. that was not the trigger point I found. So I should go back to my motivation for writing this book. So as the founder of PolitiFact, I had held off giving people my really honest observations about political lying until I left PolitiFact, and we can come back to that decision. But when I decided to write the book, I did something that few journalists have ever done. I talked to politicians and I asked them, hey, talk to me about lying. And lying in politics is widely known. Everybody knows politicians do it, but few journalists ever ask politicians about it. And so it struck me as really unusual that here is this thing that affects our politics so deeply, and yet I had never heard a journalist, nor had I myself, asked a politician, hey, why do you lie? Why do politicians lie? And journalists just don't ask that question. It seems to be seen as some sort of intrusion or something. So I decided to do that. And so I asked a lot of politicians about lying very directly. Few would admit to it themselves. I also asked this of political operatives, of the many political aides and campaign strategists and political consultants that I interviewed. So in terms of that time, the epidemic in my subtitle, many people put the beginning of that epidemic in the early 1990s and pegged it to Newt Gingrich, that the rise of Newt Gingrich as the leader of the Republican Party was really a turning point in the rise of political lying. So that's when the epidemic began. Now, we think of it now that, and we associate it, and my book cover does this very directly, with Donald Trump. And there's no question that Donald Trump has supercharged political lying. He is an epic liar that American politics has never seen before. We've had plenty of liars before, some Democrats. Bill Clinton told some big lies. Lyndon Johnson told some big lies, but none came close in volume and scale to Donald Trump. So we really are in an unprecedented moment in our political discourse. So that's the epidemic part. Why Republicans do it more. This was fascinating to me because I had seen this in my career in Washington, and this also began before Donald Trump, but once again, he supercharged it. And so as I talked to people, many of them Republicans, Republican politicians, most of them that would talk to me, Republicans who had left the party, or Republicans who were never Trumpers, as they're known, they pegged that at the Newt Gingrich moment, that it was Newt who changed the culture of the party and said, anything goes. Our cause is so important that it's okay to lie. Several people mentioned a moment when Newt, when he took over the House, allowed Republicans to have speeches to the C-SPAN cameras and gave the illusion that there was an audience there when there wasn't. But the C-SPAN cameras were locked, so they wouldn't pan to show that there was an empty house. And so the members would give these speeches as if they were addressing the House of Representatives, and they were just speaking to an empty chamber. So that, in many ways, was a lie, came to be known as cam scam. And that sort of embodied Newt Gingrich's approach and this culture that came to take root in the Republican Party. And a Republican congressman summed it up for me. He said that Republicans see their quest as an epic crusade, that it is so important for them to win, to dominate, that there's no sense of compromise. There is just this sense that they must win at any cost. And that means lying again and again about anything. if they have to. And so they will lie again and again about the same talking points. They build these false narratives, as we've seen on immigration, on crime, on race, and just serve those narratives with lies again and again. And I heard that repeatedly from people. And with a shrinking demographic of their base, an older white base, the Republicans need to do that. Anyway, that explains the second part. And then how it could burn down our democracy. We saw this firsthand after the 2020 election, that the lies about the 2020 election led to the attack on the Capitol and could once again lead to a collapse of our electoral system. I think we were fortunate this time that it was very clear that Donald Trump won the election and there were no doubts about who won, because I think lies about the election were ready to go if it had been a close election. So anyway, that's the explanation of a long subtitle and a lot of what's in the book. But I should make the point about the book. It's a book written by a journalist, me, and it is a book meant to be accessible. It's not a political science e-book. It's a book of stories, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. You mentioned that it was readable. I was glad to hear you say that. I wrote it so that it had characters that you cared about. And even one character who fell for the lies about the election, I hope when you read his story, you care about him. I did. I found his story fascinating. And he went to prison briefly, and of course has since been pardoned along with all the other January 6th rioters. But it's a book that is not a ton of analysis. It's told through a series of stories.
I don't want to take a long time with this follow-up question here because we have a lot to cover. But since we're a show about using the principles of logic to connect relevant, accurate information to our conclusions and beliefs, what evidence did you have, other than the intuition from talking to people, what evidence did you have to make the claim that Republicans lie more?
You bet. And that's important. So I relied on data analysis from fact-checking done by PolitiFact, the site that I founded, thousands of fact-checks that PolitiFact had done, and I'd have to look in the book to remind myself how many thousands we used. And then we also looked at fact-checks done by the Washington Post fact-checker and analyzed those and found there, too, that the Washington Post fact-checker had found the same thing. Now, I should be clear, and I make this clear in the book, that the data that we used is based on journalism. So this is not like the fact-checkers have randomly chosen claims and sampled them. And so people could reasonably say, well, there's selection bias. And Republicans have often said that about the fact-checkers. I think if you look at any fact-checking organization, you're going to see that they find overall that Republicans lie more. And so Republicans have often said it's the liberal media that is selecting. And my answer to them when I was PolitiFact editor, so I founded PolitiFact and I ran it for 7 years. My answer to them was, okay, show us what claims we should be checking of Democrats that we're not checking that you believe are false. And so we were always open to check claims by Democrats. And we did often, you know, many times. And the reality was they just weren't there, that there just were not as many false claims by Democrats. And that was just consistent over the years. This was not a new phenomenon. This was true when one of the first criticisms of PolitiFact was published in about 2010, and they found the same general pattern that persisted over the years. and, you know, and claimed selection bias on our part. To me, I looked at that like my answer to my staff was, welcome to my nightmare. You know, like, wouldn't it be nice if lying was equal? And, well, of course, wouldn't it be nice if there was no lying?
It didn't exist. Yeah.
but, you know, from our standpoint, it would have been so nice if lying was equal, because then we wouldn't have this constant complaint that we were biased. And even today, like, I got an email last week from somebody who claimed that there was selection bias by PolitiFact, and I'm no longer affiliated. But the fact that Republicans lie more made our work so much more difficult, because this imbalance made it hard to report on the imbalance. And you can't not report on the imbalance. But then Democrats would say that we were too hard on Democrats because they felt like we put our thumb on the scale to give Democrats false ratings that they didn't deserve just because we were trying to show that we were hard on Democrats. So anyway, yeah, all that just to show that, you know, obviously we thought a lot about this. I have no reservations at all about the data that we used or the conclusions that I reached. To me, there's absolutely no doubt. And in fact, if anything, the disparity between the amount of lying by Republicans has only increased. There is so much more lying today by Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the Republican leadership, than by the Democrats, than there was before.
Yeah, I think that resonates with a lot of people probably, and I can see how that's a tricky catch 22 for sure. I just really want to emphasize something you said earlier, really stuck with me, which is you said something like, to be a journalist is to have a license for curiosity. And I really love that, because Bob and I have talked a lot about curiosity on this show and how so much of, you know, the work we do in critical thinking starts there with just having an open, curious mind and wanting to know more. That being said, you know, lying is not a monolith. I might think about different types of lying. The thing that comes to mind is, you know, we talk about white lies and things like that. In your book, I think it's the second chapter of your book is titled A Taxonomy of Lying. Can you give us a quick run through on that taxonomy and what politicians lie about? How do they lie? And I'd love to hear a little bit more about the truth-o-meter that was created on PolitiFact.
The taxonomy of lying was something that the editor of my book asked for that I hadn't really thought about in any systematic way. And we, you know, we had always sort of been like, at PolitiFact, we had decided not to call out politicians for certain kinds of mistakes. Like if they made kind of a slip of the tongue mistake, you know, we wouldn't give them a pants on fire, you know. We felt like there was also a certain license for hyperbole, although that became difficult to apply. But so for the book, my editor said, hey, let's try to sort out lies. So for the taxonomy, this was a fascinating exercise that, like many things in the book, were the product of discussions with my students. So I have tremendous students here at Duke who helped me with the book. Some were part of a class that I taught called Lying in Politics. Others were research assistants that I hired. In the case of this chapter, they were research assistants that I hired. We had an exercise on a whiteboard where we just sort of went through different ways of looking at lying. And so I came up with sort of working with them different categories. One was severity. Like there's just sort of a recognition that lying had different levels of severity. White lies, like you referred to, under the lights mistakes. This would be like, you know, you're live on camera, you make a mistake. That's not the same as repeating the same lie over and over again. Then a misdemeanor lie. And this might be like getting inflation wrong, you know, by a few points or something. And then there would be a like what we called a felony lie, which would be something really serious. Maybe it would be targeted at someone. So that was our sense of severity. Then we had types of lies, and this was, I thought, also valuable. And we categorized these into lies about accomplishments, like boasting. This is the kind of thing you might see where someone might put it on their resume. You might have self-defense lies where someone would deny having, if they're accused of something, they might deny it. Lies attacking opponents. When we put lies into a big spreadsheet and categorize them, there were a ton of these because so many lies, and we know this if we turn on our television during a campaign, are lies attacking an opponent. And then just lies about policy and issues. This might be, you know, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, those kinds of lies. And then finally, how they lie, and that might be repetition, where they just repeat the same lie over and over again. Might be cherry picking, where they pick out a specific time period and try to use that, or just simply exaggeration. Anyway, really loved that chapter. It was funny because it was one of these things where the editor wanted it, and I was like, I don't know. And I was really glad to write that. So you asked about the truth-o-meter. It's my greatest, one of my greatest points of pride in my career. I had a moment once. I was in Reagan National Airport, and a woman came up to me. I was talking to a TV reporter from CBS News, and I thought she recognized him. And no, she recognized me because I was on Morning Joe a lot. And she came up to me and she said, "You're the truth-o-meter guy." And I was so heartwarmed by that. So the truth-o-meter was the way that PolitiFact rates the accuracy of political statements. And this was an idea I had that was really the heart of PolitiFact. How could we rate things to summarize for people the accuracy of a statement, recognizing that there's shades of gray, that not everything is either true or false. There's usually some in between. You know, we knew the phrase, there's a half truth. Now, some people reject this idea. I've had arguments with one journalist who just hated the whole concept. And he's like, there's no such thing as a half truth. And I was like, yeah, there is. So I originally came up with five levels: true, mostly true, half true, what we originally called barely true. It's now called mostly false, and then false. And then we added a final level that we call pants on fire. That is the most ridiculous falsehood. And that's the level people love. And one of the things that's distinctive about PolitiFact is you can go to PolitiFact and sort ratings, and you can say, show me all the false ratings, or show me all the false ratings by Chuck Schumer, you know, or show me all the false ratings by Gavin Newsom. And you can do that. And so that's one of the things that distinguishes PolitiFact from most other fact checkers, is that it's published as a database. So that's the truth-o-meter. One thing we can come back to later, sort of, is that working? Answer, not with everybody. But it's a great way to sort fact checks.
Of course, PolitiFact has always been on our list of resources to give to our listeners when vetting information. You talked about before in writing the book that you wanted to bring it to life with real stories. There is a chapter in your book that has the ominous title, Orwellian title, The Ministry of Truth. And it tells a story about Nina Jankowicz. And it's a familiar story for us because several years back we had a guest, former research manager at the Stanford Internet Observatory, Rene DiResta, who had a similar experience as Nina did, but give us a brief version of what happened with Nina and why that's important enough to have a chapter in your book on.
You bet. I had a goal in writing this book that I wanted chapters about people who embody different aspects of lying. I wanted one person who had fallen for lies, and that was, I chose a guy who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, so he had fallen for the big lie about the election. I wanted a chapter about someone who chose to tell a lie, so I wrote a chapter about a guy who lied in a political campaign and made a false ad. And I wanted a character who had been a victim of lying, and that was Nina. So Nina ran or was hired to run an agency with the worst name ever. It was called the Disinformation Governance Board, and it was part of the Department of Homeland Security, and it really didn't really have much authority. It was just an internal coordinating council. It was supposed to get all the agencies in this big department together and get them to coordinate better in their efforts on disinformation. But because it emerged from inside the Department of Homeland Security bureaucracy, they gave it a terrible name, a very bureaucratic name, the Disinformation Governance Board. And it really didn't govern in any way. It really was just coordinating. But if you look at the memos that show its birth, you can see well-intentioned bureaucrats who don't communicate well. And it's sad, they wouldn't talk to me because I don't think these people were malicious in any way. I think they were just not very thoughtful about how they came up with the name. They also were not thoughtful about how they publicly announced this thing. So they leak it to Politico and it comes out, and immediately, and Politico just puts like a 3-sentence blurb in a newsletter. And instantly the conservatives start attacking it because they had a narrative going. And the narrative was that the Biden administration wants to censor you. And so this fit right in. Disinformation Governance Board, and they quickly named it the Ministry of Truth. And they just started lying. They said it was going to censor what you could put on the internet. They were going to censor your tweets. And they started lying about its director, Nina Jankowicz. And lie after lie after lie, and started off on Twitter. And then it spread to talk radio, it spread to Congress, and it spread to the heart of the conservative message machine, Fox News. And people on Fox, whether it was Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity, their guests, other shows, just villainized Nina Jankowicz with lie after lie after lie. And it was really terrible to see this. And when you go back and you read the transcripts and you see how this built and built and built, and what this does with people who aren't getting facts about this, because there was no fact checking. PolitiFact did no fact checks about this. The Washington Post did no fact checks about this. There was no one saying, hey, here's the truth about this. And the Department of Homeland Security said nothing about it. And they were so for days. And when they finally said stuff about it, there was no amplification by members of Congress, members of the House, members of the Senate. And the White House was clumsy about it. So nobody could match the lying and repeated lying that followed this Biden wants to censor you narrative. And so they just kept lying and lying and lying. And it just got worse and worse. And it's just, it's really tragic. And so I decided to just follow Nina's story, and that becomes the backbone of the book. And there are three chapters about Nina and then the epilogue. So you ride along with Nina and you see what she went through as they lied about her. They lied about her singing because she had been active in theater, in musical theater. And so they found videos of her singing and they lied about that. And it was just terrible.
It's a textbook example on the harms that can come from lying in politics. And it's also a textbook example on how not to counter those lies, you know, what we need to do to actually change those lies around.
Absolutely. And I was pretty hard on the Biden administration in those chapters because I really felt they could have pushed back and defended Nina early on. And I think disarmed the critics to a large extent. You know, at one point, one of the members of Congress goes on the floor of the House and takes the lyrics of a satiric song that Nina has sung, treats them as if Nina has said them, and that includes the F-bomb, treats it as if Nina has said that in real life, and says, is this the kind of woman that we want, you know, in government? And like, she said that in character in a cabaret song, you know, but that doesn't matter. I think this was, I can't remember which member of Congress it was, but it was just preposterous. But that's the way they lie, you know, and like anything goes because they just want to win. And the Democrats were just missing in action. The Democrats didn't care. They just got their clock cleaned, and it was a real sad turn of events.
Well, getting into big lies, as your book's main title refers to, the big lie, referring to the 2020 presidential election being rigged, has been claimed by a lot of people, and the presidency was stolen away from Donald Trump in 2020. You offer five main reasons why people fell for this lie. What are they? Help us understand how this happened.
You bet. So this is at the end of my chapter about a guy named Eric Barber. And so Eric was a city council member from Parkersburg, West Virginia, who stormed the Capitol along with the hordes of people on January 6th. And I chose to focus on Eric. I sort of auditioned, so to speak, a few different people by... I wrote a one-act play, and by taking the testimony of people who had testified before the January 6th committee, and I had my students perform it and in class, and sort of use that to figure out who had the most compelling story of different people who had testified. And it was clear that Eric was a really interesting character. So Eric had been a Democrat and had switched parties to try to save his political career and became a Republican and found that on Facebook, he got a lot more love, a lot more likes when he posted extreme conservative things. And likewise, he got a lot of his information from clips on Facebook, often from Fox News. And so Eric talked to me gave some really detailed testimony to the January 6th committee, was the subject of a documentary. And so put all these things combined, and I had a pretty good account of Eric's story. And so when you put them all together, came to see when you match Eric, sort of overlay what the factors in his life with the academic studies on how people fall for the lies about the 2020 election. I sort of grouped it into the five areas that you said. One was the lack of skepticism. Now, this is just a pretty common finding in how we approach things. And this is how a University of Alabama named Timothy Levine sums things up, that our preferred position is to believe that the world is telling us the truth, that, you know, sort of, it's just a sort of a lack of skepticism. And so when Trump supporters hear Trump say the election was rigged, their default position is, well, Donald Trump said it. And then that overconfident consumers fall for fake news, that people tend to overestimate their ability to discern between credible things and false headlines. And people who do are more likely to engage with inaccurate news sources. Another factor is the home team mentality, which is known as directionally motivated reasoning, something I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. Another factor was Fox. Eric was getting a lot of his information from Fox. And Fox, as we know from the depositions in the Dominion case, was peddling so many falsehoods about the election. My colleague, Brian Stelter, put out a book called Network of Lies, that it really, you know, they were just perpetuating the lies, even when people behind the scenes at Fox knew the truth, that Joe Biden had won the election. And then finally, repetition, that studies have shown that particularly people on the right are more likely to believe something when they hear a falsehood over and over again.
One of the things I hear from my friends on the left, I hear this all the time, is they scratch their head and say, why can people believe this? How, what makes them believe this? But let's move into something that I think is really germane to our listeners, people who want to apply what we're saying to critical thinking. Let's dig in deeply to the process of fact-checking itself. What are the details about how professional fact-checking is actually done?
So, and this is true, I think, for PolitiFact, The Washington Post, factcheck.org, New York Times, AP, you know, that on any given day, fact-checkers are listening, monitoring, what are the significant statements that are being said that are questionable? So this actually goes back to what I talked about at the beginning. What are we curious about? What are people saying that we're wondering, really? Is that true? And that's the curiosity. You know, so as a journalist, that curiosity that fueled me when I was a local news reporter is also what fueled me as a fact checker. When I hear something and I wonder, really? Are people eating dogs and cats in Springfield, Ohio? You know, that's really the question. And I still get that all the time. And I get it about Democrats, you know, a lot too, that you'll hear a Democrat say something and you're like, really? Did Elon Musk do that? So I heard one the other, you know, like Elon Musk attacking people for attacking Tesla. And I heard this thing and I was like, really? I want to look into that, you know? And so that's sort of the first thing for fact checkers, is to decide what to check. So then the next process is to go to the person who made the claim and say, where did you get that information? And that's important because often in investigative reporting, that part, sort of confronting the source, comes later, where you sort of gather all the stuff and then you go to the source and you're like, all right, we've been looking into you. Now we got the goods. What do you say? You know? And so now that's investigative reporting. And typically, you know, you would often go later to the person after you know whether you have the case, whether you can really make the case. In fact checking, though, you do that first. Hey, White House, we're looking into this claim that Donald Trump made, you know, where did he get this? the latest one in the last week before we recorded this is Joe Biden signed all these pardons with an auto pen. Hey, White House, where do you get this? And like so many things, they don't have anything to back it up. They're just saying it. And so that's problematic. And so we had a rule that would say, hey, we'll look to see if there's something to back up your claim. But ultimately, the person who makes the claim has an obligation to be able to back it up. But a lot of lies are people just saying stuff without anything to back it up. So we look into that and try, but often can't find anything. And I think that's where the auto pen thing started and will ultimately end up. There's just not proof there. But it sounds good. Oh my God. It's just an auto pen that's run amok and pardoned all these guys, and so there's no proof of that. But of course, Biden hasn't denied it, so it looks like it might be true. Anyway, the process that PolitiFact uses is quite impressive. At a time when so many journalists publish things without any editing, PolitiFact still has an editor who line edits the story. And then usually three editors who review and decide on the Truthometer rating. Now that's impressive. And now that's not true for spot decisions. Like if it's being made quickly during a live event, usually it's one editor. But on a typical Truthometer rating now, it's still three editors that decide on the Truthometer rating. And I'm so proud that they still do that. That's how it works. It's one of the, I think it's, a gold standard in American journalism, and they do tremendous work.
Great resource, certainly.
I use it all the time. Like I'll hear stuff and I'll be like, really? Is that true? And inevitably PolitiFact checked it out, and it turns out.
I assume none of those editors are AI driven.
So we talk about AI because I do think there's the potential to use AI to clone human written fact checks. But no, there's no AI written fact checks by PolitiFact or any of the other U.S. fact checkers.
Yeah, so I'm asking this question with this in mind as both using PolitiFact and other fact-checking established organizations as a resource for checking things out when they see it on Facebook, but also for actually the person themselves getting into the process. PolitiFact, as you described it, would have a little advantage to just say me calling up, to try to check the administration's sources for something being said, in that they would probably at least respond to PolitiFact. But let's say that they did respond, you were checking out the source, there was no source, they could not give you a source, or they gave you a source and you could see that that was exaggerated or not really true, or let's say they had no evidence at all, then the fact checker went further and tried to look for any evidence that's out there for it and didn't find it, then to give it a rating, how would that be rated? Would that be a pants on fire? I know it's hard to answer the question generally.
It's a very complex process because it depends on a few things. One, the specific wording of the claim. That it is, when the politician made the claim, did they hedge at all? Did they include words that, like, many, most of the time? So were they careful in their wording? I often thought, gosh, I could make money as a consultant to politicians to tell them how to be more careful with their wording, which of course I would not do. But, it's like, it wouldn't take much to be a little more careful about these things. I've had conversations with the people who make campaign ads, and they, particularly on the Democratic side, they actually put a lot of thought into what wording they might use. On the Obama campaign, they would have conversations with their research team, and the research team would meet with the ad makers, and the ad makers would say, okay, this is what we want to say. What rating would PolitiFact give us? And the ad makers would be like, we'll probably get a mostly false for that one. And then the ad people would be like, well, what if we said it this way? And then the research people would see, I think that would get a half true. You know, so like they do think about that stuff. It's a process that I think has integrity, but ultimately it is subjective. I've taken tremendous amount of heat for it over the years, and I've also gotten a tremendous amount of praise for it over the years. I'm very proud of it. It does a great service to people.
Yeah, just a couple other questions on the details, and we're getting a little short on time, so we'll try and rush this and then get to one other question before we wrap it up. But what I was wondering is, with PolitiFact, when you had to hire somebody to be a fact checker, what kind of qualities did you look for?
Great question, Bob. You want someone who's not partisan. You want someone who is incredibly thorough. You want someone who can distill information quickly. Here is the best embodiment of this is a reporter named Lou Jacobson, who is a PolitiFact reporter. He's, I believe his title now is senior correspondent. I hired him in 2010. He just celebrated, I think, his 15th year there. And this guy writes so fast. He can distill information so fast. He's so fair. I can tell you, like, I've known him 15 years. I have no idea what political party he is. And that's great. I don't want to know. He's tremendous.
I have just one more question on the details of fact checking, and that's, how can we get more people to actually buy in to the idea that fact checking is on the up and up and it's a real thing, and gain trust in the fact checking organizations?
So that's difficult, because the conservative media, and we need to be honest about this, this is a problem on the right. And I wish this were not so, just like I wish that Republicans were not the ones that lied more. But this is the world we live in, and this is the world that I inherited as one of the people in the fact-checking movement. So what can we do to get people on the right to trust fact-checking more? One thing is to get more conservative media organizations to fact check. And I think that involves getting foundations to give them money. And there are foundations on the right that I have spoken to that are curious about doing this. There are organizations on the right like The Dispatch, which is a center right media organization that grew out of another media organization, I'm drawing a blank on the name, that does fact checking. So I think we need more fact checking on the right. The other thing I think we need to do is experiment with different forms of journalism that may not necessarily look like fact checks. I think for as great as the Truthometer is, it's not working with conservative audiences. And I think we need to come up with new forms of things that may not actually be fact checks that can convey the same information. And I'm working on that.
In our last couple minutes here at the show, we saved the big question for last. In the last chapter in Beyond the Big Lie, it's titled, How Can We Stop the Lying? And so that's my question to you. How can we stop the lying?
We have to make honesty cool again. And so I think there are a few things we can do to do that. One that I suggest in the book is something that Republicans really embrace for taxes, and that is a pledge. Republicans sign a pledge that says we won't raise taxes. If we could do the same thing, a pledge that says I won't lie. I won't lie in campaigns. I won't lie in government. I think that could be a wonderfully simple approach to that. And we just need someone or some organization to take that on and get candidates to do that. And I think that's not partisan. How could anyone oppose that? Like, that's just wonderfully simple. How could anyone be, I'm for lying, you know? No, I'm not going to sign that. So I think that's one thing. Another that I was thinking about just this weekend is, anytime we have an interaction with a politician that has been caught in a falsehood by a fact checker, we should just say, hey, you know, I saw that you got a false rating from PolitiFact or the local newspaper or whatever. You know, I don't like politicians who lie. And, you know, you may have a reason for that one, but please, for me, lying is something I care about, and I don't want my politicians to lie. And I think if we do that in our individual interactions with politicians, I think that will make a difference.
We're running really short of time, Bill, and I want to refer folks to your book because I know that you brainstormed with your students about other ways that we can deal with this. So I encourage people to get the book, Beyond the Big Lie, The Epidemic of Political Lying, Why Republicans Do It More, and How It Could Burn Down Our Democracy. And do want to thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and experiences with us, Bill, on Thinking Clearly here, and making that experience available in that very readable book. And on our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to your personal website at billadair.com. That's BILLADAIR.com. And also to your faculty website at Duke University and to the Duke Reporters Lab. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
That sounds fine. The Reporters Lab one's sort of in transition, so I'm not sure that one offers an awful lot, but feel free if you think it's worthy. But all that sounds great. And thank you so much.
Appreciate you joining us.
And also a big shout out to our listeners. Thank you for your support. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.